we want to get to yes or no as fast as we can. I don't like wasting people's time. People don't like their time being wasted.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network, CREPN Radio. This is episode number 66. Weekly, we share interviews with real estate experts, passing on their experience and knowledge. Thanks for joining us this week. My name is Jade Aaron Gross. We're so glad you're here. In just a minute, we're going to speak with Jeff Sumter. Jeff is a founder and co-president of a community bank in Oregon, Lewis and Clark Bank. Jeff talks with us about community banks and what they can do for you, and how a community bank is different from a national bank. For those listeners who have a community bank relationship, you'll appreciate this and enjoy this. And for those of you who do not yet have a community bank relationship, I think you're going to find the value of working with one. If this is your first time tuning in, we want to welcome you to the program. And if you are a returning listener, thanks for coming back. We're so glad you're here. You can help us grow the audience by subscribing to the program. It's easy. If you haven't done it yet, let me tell you how to do it. Whether you use iTunes or Stitcher, we're on both. Just go to either one that you like to use. And in the search bar, type in Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. And when you do that, you'll see our logo will pop up. It's the headphones with CREPN between the ears. Go ahead and click subscribe, and you're done. Then when a new episode is posted, all you have to do is click download and shazam. You're listening to another episode of Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. My personal favorite place to listen is either while I'm in the car or out on a bike ride or even when I'm out walking the dog. When you subscribe, this helps us attract guests, and podcasts are measured by the number of subscribers. So please, if you would, we'd love to have you subscribe. When you do subscribe, be sure to leave a comment and let us know what you think. A little bit about myself for our new listeners. I am a real estate investor and I'm also a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for over 25 years. My primary clients are real estate professionals dealing in multifamily, retail, warehouse, office, and development. And I'm also a real estate investor and I have been for 20 plus years. And because of these two things, I'm constantly looking for more information about real estate, whether it's to use my own investing or so I can better support my clients. My goal is to learn and share with you information that you can use in your real estate business. And that's how Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio came about. The easiest way to reach me is if you go to the contact button on the page CommercialRealEstatePronetwork.com, and go ahead and click on that, and you can send me a message or reach out to me, and be happy to talk to you if it's whether it's about a deal or just catch up. If you've got any kind of an insurance question, I'm happy to listen to you there and do what I can to help. And as I say that, insurance it's something that, you know, most people would rather not talk about. Trust me, I know this. But insurance is part of any real estate transaction. And this last week, just a real quick story, a listener reached out to me and asked if I would take a look at some coverage they had on a property they had under contract. They received a quote. And sure, I offered to do that. And collected a little bit of information and presented a proposal. And the first thing they told me was that my offer was 20% higher than their other offer. And so I asked if they'd go ahead and send it to me, their other offer, just so I could compare. And again, my goal was not necessarily to make the sale, but make certain that the listener was getting what they needed to protect themselves. And again, if the sale happened, great, but that was not my reason to be doing this. Anyway, so they sent it over, and there were a couple of things. I mean, one, the price was 20% lower than what I was presenting. But there were a couple of reasons for that. And when I pointed them out to the listener, they thanked me. One was the building, the actual coverage amount that the other proposal was using was significantly lower. It was based on a purchase price, not on what an actual cost to rebuild the property was. The other proposal did not include loss of rents. If you did have a loss and you weren't able to collect rents, you'd be without rents. And mine did have a loss of rents. And also they had a deductible on their liability, which I pointed out to them. I pointed this out to them. They were extremely grateful. And in the end, they did ask me to take care of their insurance needs. But again, I share this with you not because I'm wanting everybody to do that, but I just want you to know I'm available and I'm happy to do that if I can help you out. So with that, if you have anything you would like to talk about, go ahead and reach out to me and we'll do what we can to help. All right. Lastly, before we get on with the show, if you are on LinkedIn, we do have a group. It's called Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. It's a great place to go network with commercial real estate professionals, and I hope you'll do that. All right. Let's get on with this show. Today, our guest I'm excited to have is Jeff Sumter. He's a founder and the co-president of Lewis and Clark Bank in Oregon. He was also recognized in 2009 as a member of the 40 Under 40 from the list produced by the Portland Business Journal. And also, I was reading a book the other night. I saw he was mentioned in Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, if you could, before we get going here a little bit, could you tell us or tell the audience, myself, a little bit more about you and your path to co-president there at Lewis and Clark Bank?
Sure. Well, we'll try to make this fairly short, but, probably like a lot of people that found their way into careers that they find themselves in today, I didn't really set out to be a banker. Wanted actually to be a history teacher. And when I got out of the military, I was going to school part-time and got a part-time job at U.S. Bank, which if you're from Oregon and in banking, you probably have worked for U.S. Bank at some point. And started off there, and then one thing led to another and kind of turned into a full-time thing. And I did that for quite a while, and then after the old U.S. Bank of Oregon merged with the bank out of the Midwest, I had the opportunity to go to a small community bank and work with somebody that had actually retired from U.S. that I knew pretty well and was kind of a mentor for me. And so I thought I'd give a small bank a try, not really knowing much about a small bank versus a big bank, just kind of thinking it's a small version of the same thing, and found out over time that it really was not. And that bank that I went to was just a few years old and very small. And did that for a number of years, which was a great experience, and learned a lot, doing everything from start to finish, and really learning how all that, process works. And met, turns out to be my business partner now, Trey Most. He came on board in 2003, to that small bank. And we were about the same age and had kind of similar ideas on how we would do it different. The idea of taking care of both the client and top talent within the organization. And I said to him one day, we should just start our own bank. I was kind of joking. And he took it serious. And then, and that was in 2004, we started the process of putting a bank together.
And what is that process? I mean, you have an idea, that's one thing, but to actually
do it? Well, yeah. Being that it was before the recession, it seemed like a great idea. But what we did, we started in 2004. we just started talking about it and trying to think about, okay, if we were to do this, what would it look like? What would we want to do? All that. So once we decided that's something we'd want to pursue, we started talking to people that had done it before. And then they would tell us to go, you know, you need to go talk to this person. And that person would tell us, well, you know, you should talk to this other person. And that's not just bankers, but attorneys and, you know, regulators and the whole thing. So we spent probably a year just doing that, just maybe on a fact-finding mission. And through all that, and I think, you know, asking a lot of questions and you know, really kind of understanding, let's say, the why of all those people. You mentioned Simon Sinek's book. We kind of developed what we would want to do and how we would go about doing it. And then we got serious about it, talked to some other people that we had worked with in the past, got a group of four or five of us together, and then we got after it in earnest in the beginning of 2006. And then you put your business plan together, get the board together, you talk to the regulators, and this takes a lot of, you know, attorney time that somebody's been through it and that kind of stuff. And then when you get kind of the okay from the regulators, at least the nod, then you go out and raise capital, which we did. And we raised just under $14 million in capital. And as soon as you hit that minimum capital, the FDIC, in our case, the FDIC in the state of Oregon, as the chartering agencies, allow you to open once you hit that capital requirement. And so we opened almost 10 years ago, 10 years ago next month.
Wow. I've read kind of how you do it and stuff and just your timeline there. So you started talking about in 2003-ish, is that right?
2004. Yeah, it was the beginning of 2004, yes.
Okay. And so almost a better part of 3 years if we're near the end of 16, or I'm sorry, you said 2006, it'll be 10 years
right
here. So
yeah, I think a lot of people do it faster. I think the first thing that we wanted to do is decide, did it make financial sense? Did we think we could, you know, do something better or more effectively than maybe is being done in the market? You know, all those reasons that anybody would start a business. We spent a lot of time thinking about that. And then the added, you know, regulatory complexity and those kinds of things, we had to make sure we really understood, did we think we could get it done? Because, you know, you have to quit your job. Other people are quitting their jobs. Trey and I funded most of the seed capital. And so, you know, both of us have spouses that have been in their jobs a long time. So when you come home and you say, hey, I'm going to quit my job and we're going to start a bank and maybe in a year we'll get this thing open, was not the greatest conversation to have with a wife that's very risk adverse. So,
right,
you know, there was a lot of buy-in we had to get over that time. But really it was about a year full-time start to finish when we really, you know, got after it and started down that path.
Well, and you mentioned your start year of 2006. So clearly you've weathered one of the most traumatic times in banking. I can only imagine that was made for some interesting times, or did it create more opportunities given the landscape of banking there?
That's a really good question. It's actually a little bit of both. I'm sure it took a couple years off my life having gone through that, and a lot of that has to do with just uncertainty, and certainly the regulatory agencies were really concerned as they started to see banks fail. We were in a little bit different situation as that we were still considered a de novo. So you already have, within your first 3 years as a new bank, a lot more regulatory scrutiny, as you should. you're just getting started, and so they visit you, and the rules are much more confining. Well, the FDIC on a national level moved that from 3 years to 7 years when we were at the end of the 3 years. So, you know, while that wasn't the greatest situation to be in, to be put back in that, you know, de novo category, which means, you know, you have to have your business plan for the next 4 years, you know, laid out and approved and all that, and you do get the more frequent visits. Because we had no control over those things, we spent a lot of time working on the things that we could control. And we can control what we do, process, you know, all the things that you have to do to, internally to a company to make sure you're running efficiently, risk management, all those things. So it made us much better, I think, that way. And, which was the second part of your question, you know, the market, there was a lot of market disruption. And so because we didn't, you know, we didn't have problems that a lot of banks kind of found themselves in as the economy started to improve. I think we kind of jumped out of the chutes faster than most because we weren't handcuffed by you know, lots of problems and lots of internal things that we had to deal with. So, you know, it was the good and the bad, but I think, you know, I think we're better as an organization from an operational perspective than we would have been otherwise.
Makes sense. I hadn't thought about it too much there, but obviously not having an inventory of loans that were starting to rot there at the time when the whole thing was going upside down was probably a benefit for you guys. Like I said, the ability to start out of the chute without all the kind of the baggage there.
Yes, a lot of the banks did have a lot of baggage, and certainly we had, you know, we had made, since we were getting started at the end of 06, we'd made a number of loans in 07, which turns out in Oregon and the Portland metro area, that was the peak. So we certainly had, you know, our share of loans to deal with. I think at the end of the day, because of the kind of clients that we have, how we like to work with the clients, we never really had thought about it that way ahead of time, but as it turns out, it makes dealing, when you do have problems, it made that go much smoother. You know, the character piece of what we should do. And so our losses compared to peers were almost non-existent. If you look at our peer group, which is 06, we lost very little in any loan losses. Didn't mean we didn't have people that had financial stress and financial difficulty that we had to work with. But if you have that character issue up front, we were able to work through those things and for the most part didn't have to do anything too drastic with clients that had issues.
Well, and kudos to you. I'm assuming that was a better thing than being in some of the other banks that had to work through. I mean, there was plenty of banks getting shut down or taken over, or FDIC, you know, coming in and taking over banks. And so I'm assuming your visits were more pleasant than those visits that other banks were getting from the FDIC.
Yes, certainly the regulatory environment wasn't fun for anybody, but the banks that really had a lot of trouble, you're effectively stopped from, you're not going to grow your business, you're going to focus on the issues that you have, and we never wanted to be in that situation, so that's why we did spend so much time making sure we had a clean shop, that we had a good relationship with the regulatory agencies and those kinds of things. So, you know, those are all other parts of the job that you have to make sure you're keeping in mind all of your stakeholders, maybe is the word to use.
I want to ask you the reference there to the Simon Sinek book, Start With Why.
Yes.
I was reading the book. I try and read a little bit before I go to bed every night. And I'm reading along, and I see Jeff Sumter started a bank. in Lewis and Clark. And I'm going, I know the Lewis and Clark. That's just, and I was thinking, is this like something in my brain that was working? I had to rub my eyes a few times, like thinking maybe I'd like started to doze off. And how did you end up in the book? What do you have a relationship with Simon?
Yeah, that it's so I think Simon would appreciate that a lot of people read his book, because I've heard this story now many times where people wind up seeing our name in the book. So what happened is we heard Simon at a EO event. Trey, my business partner, was involved in the entrepreneurial organization. And at the same time, we were, you know, when we started, we kind of did all the marketing ourselves, and we kept everything pretty low cost. And so maybe 2 or 3 years into it, we decided, hey, you know, we really need to get some better looking and kind of more intentional branding. So we would meet with marketing people, and they ask you a lot of questions, and we realized that we couldn't really answer the questions all that well about why we do what we do. So about that time, we heard Simon and his whole, start with why, you know, that it isn't what we do, it's why we do certain things, and that really resonated with us. So at the end of his presentation, he said, if you will donate some money to the charity that I care a lot about, I'll give you an hour time on your business and we'll just talk. And, which we took him up on, and we wound up using somebody like Simon. Now, Simon is in New York, which made it difficult for us to engage him to do some internal culture stuff. We actually wound up hiring somebody that used to work with him. And it's the same kind of approach. But Simon asked us a lot of questions about, you know, how we got into our industries and all that kind of stuff. And great conversation. He's really interesting and pretty insightful right out of the chutes. But that conversation was over. And about a week later, I got a call from him. And so I called him back and he said, you know, I've got this example in the book and I have this fictional example. It's not banking, it's this person, and I'm trying to prove a point. And when you described how you got into banking, it was the exact situation that I was describing. So would you mind if I use you in the book? And so we talked about, again, did he have the story kind of right? And so that's how I got in there. Now, that I'm in being compared in that story to Neil Armstrong, I don't know is the best comparison and contrast, but that was trying to prove his point that, you know, most of us wind up in the jobs we're in. We're not like him where, you know, he wanted to be a pilot from 3 years old or something like that. So
Right. No, and it was because, I was reading it late, and I thought, did I just read that? And went back the next morning and checked, and by golly, there you were. So that's neat.
Yeah, for anybody that I don't know how you felt about the book. He's got another one where he kind of talks about the tribe mentality. It's leaders eat last. So I think he's got some interesting. He does some interesting work on that, and definitely worth listening to. He's got clips on his website. You know, where you can hear some TED Talks and those kinds of things. So he's certainly an interesting guy.
Well, agreed. And I've been in a presentation here. I was at a presentation he made at a conference, and impressive speaker and very clear thinker and makes a point there. And I did enjoy the book and did speak to me as well. On that topic of why, I was going to ask you, why co-president at a bank, especially in today's news? I mean, if you pick up the paper and read about one of the national banks and how the president is usually well-tanned and is maybe comfortable sitting in front of Congress being drilled and all sorts of other things that kind of go with ego and that. Why co-president?
That's another good question. I think people ask us that, and it wouldn't work certainly for everybody. I think if you went out and you got two people and said, hey, we're going to make you guys or gals co-presidents, that would be unlikely to work. But because Trey and I, you know, came up with the idea to begin with and have spent so much time, it's been, you know, 13 years now we've been working on this. It makes sense for us. You know, he has a finance background. I have more of a banking, lending, you know, background. So we really did kind of start it like a partnership from the beginning that way. And, you know, even down to even, you know, here we're 10 years in, we share the same office, which people also find interesting. But what it allows us to do is kind of talk about the business during the day, and we're not always in the office at the same time. But you know, we, from the very beginning, we did a lot of what ifs. We do what ifs about everything. We do it kind of all day long. It's just part of what we do. Not that we're going to go off in a particular direction, one way or another, but it's a good mental process for us to go through. And the other thing we noticed, the same thing that you just noticed, which is, so many banks kind of get built around the personality of the of what the or who the president or CEO or if it's the same person is. And really what we tried to prominently display in our website is the employees. Because from a client perspective, they don't really care who I am. And nor should the website be about me or Trey, for that matter. It should be about the people that interface with the clients and actually execute. So you don't see all of our directors' pictures on the walls. They're the same way. It's not about them. It's about how are we taking care of the client, and at the end of the day, the shareholders, the investors. So that's just kind of how we started it from the beginning, and we've kept it that way, and it's worked out well for us.
I want to get into just kind of the difference between a more of a national, kind of a larger bank, and a local or regional, or excuse me, is it right to say community bank or local bank? Is there a difference?
You know, I think that probably term is the same. I think it's based probably more on size. You know, get into the regional banks, and they're dealing with different issues and approaching the business a little bit different than your smaller local community banks. I think either word is appropriate.
Well, in any case, you mentioned that you had experience working for larger national banks. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see if you could kind of describe, you know, what makes a community bank better or different than a national bank.
I think different is probably the best way to put it. There are many things that national banks do, money center banks, things like that, that a small bank could never do. And we try to approach it as we are not a small, large bank. So that means we don't have everything that the larger bank's going to have. We are a niche bank. So we try to do some of those things better or different than they can. And so I think at a large national bank, efficiency, you know, segmentation, how they segment their businesses, you got lots of different silos. You're trying to all move in the same direction. Is what they do, and they can handle a lot of things that we, you know, the small banks cannot. But there's a lot of things that we can do. You know, we could take the time, deal with clients one-on-one. You know, we don't have a underwriting system, you know, some kind of an algorithm that people plug things into. We, you know, can take the time to kind of understand what the borrower wants to do. I guess it would be like working with, well, in your business, an online, you know, do you want online insurance, or do you want to deal with somebody that actually knows about the insurance and can help you? For some people, You know, the online's probably okay, but for a lot of people, having that additional expertise, and maybe that's what we can bring in the markets that we actually work in, some expertise in a particular item where it becomes too expensive for a large bank to have experts, let's say, in small business lending in every single market that they have. You know, it'd be very hard to do, where a small bank can get very focused and hire staff around certain things that they want to do and bring to the market.
You mentioned that you guys are a commercial bank. Is that
yes,
as opposed to a consumer bank? Is that what's
well? So in those terms, when you say commercial bank, the comparisons would be like a savings and loan or a thrift, which there really isn't any. There's very few real thrifts left. There was also mutual banks. So a commercial bank would be, you know, what most people would think is of a bank. Make business loans, can make consumer loans, have checking accounts and for businesses as well, where some of those other entities focused more just on consumers. So we can do consumer loans, but we, for the most part, choose not to. You know, one of the downsides of the regulation is a lot of focus on consumer regulation. Since we never really did much of it to begin with, when you only do a few loans, it becomes very hard to get the expertise, is I guess the right word, to make sure that you're not running afoul of any consumer type compliance regulations. So we choose to stay away from that for the most part.
Is the compliance you're talking about, is that all out of the I can't remember what the name of the bill or whatever the passage from the 08 was, that the
Dodd-Frank.
Is that Dodd-Frank, what that's
yeah,
all about?
Well, there was already lots of consumer compliance, which in my view, Dodd-Frank was certainly an overreaction, especially if you're a small bank. Now, for the most part, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, does not regulate the small banks, but as new regulations get passed, it impacts us. And it's just so many rules and so many things to stay on top of. It just becomes very difficult for a bank that doesn't do many loans like that to stay on top of every rule and regulation. So that's what we chose not to.
Well, and personally, I can vouch. I've had a relationship with Lewis and Clark Bank for a number of years now, and just the process from in the beginning to even now, it doesn't feel like it's changed with respects to, like you said, a conversation and the ability to have that conversation, meet in person, and you know, lay it out, and then let it be presented to the loan committee, and a week later or so, or however long you guys need. It didn't seem like there's anything, and I don't know that I was asking for anything crazy, as opposed to an experience I had with just the, like you said, on the consumer side of things. It was just like on and on and on and on, more and more information, and they've tried to essentially streamline it by putting it all online, to where all you're getting are these electronic document signed stuff that, you know, they just keep presenting more and more and more and more and more and more of this, to where I don't know the consumer really knows what they're getting into now, even though they're supposed to be more protected.
that's a great point.
Well, yeah,
I would say this is my personal opinion, not the opinion of Lewis and Clark Bank or anybody else here. My personal opinion is that it has done exactly what you said. There are so many things in the guise of protection that it's overload. And so when you have, you know, a foot deep of information, and then you're going to sign electronically signed documents that, you know, are 100 pages long, I don't see, in my view, I don't see how the consumer was protected by that. I think you know less today trying to get a mortgage loan because, like you say, you don't even understand why they want what they want. It's just more and more and more. So I don't see how the consumer was protected any further by that. But that's just my opinion.
Well, and I'm certain there were intentions were probably good, but I just think that sometimes the efforts don't match or the results don't match the intent, which is not uncommon. Let's talk a little bit about kind of your guys' process, because I kind of described my experience. A lot of our listeners are real estate professionals, investors. What is it that a community bank, I mean, when somebody has a, let's just say they're looking to buy a property, an investment property, and they come to Lewis and Clark or a community bank, what are some of the, I guess, the differences, the strengths that a community bank like Lewis and Clark has compared to whether it be the brokerage or a larger national bank?
Sure. So if you're working on a project, let's say, you know, real estate related, that is size and scope that fits well in a community bank portfolio, then from a process perspective, I think that what you're getting is the ability to talk through what you're trying to accomplish with your lender. And so the bigger you get, the more, you know, efficiencies you try to get, the less you're going to get somebody at the front end that really maybe understands the process all the way through. Then you wind up getting people that are more like business development people. Which is nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's a different way to go about it. So, can you get, if you go with a national bank and everything that you do fits in the box that they have, which is very defined, and you do everything exactly the way they want you to do it, you will probably get a better rate than you'll be able to get at a community bank. Tell people that up front. But again, it's the Walmart versus, you know, think of some customized product. So, for example, you come in, you talk to one of our lenders. Lenders pretty much know what's going to be required to be able to get a project done or something done here, because it's what they do every day. And they're involved with the loan from start to finish. So I think what we try to do, and it kind of goes back to Simon's comments you were talking about in the book, is understand what it is you're trying to do, why you're trying to do it, what you're trying to accomplish, and all that. Because maybe there's more than one way to get something done. You know, if you go to McDonald's, you want a cheeseburger, that's exactly what you want. But if the question is more, this is the end point that I'm trying to get to, you know, what we try to look for is, well, maybe it can't be done the way that you came in with, but maybe there's another way we can get that done. Maybe if you did it this way or that way or whatever. And I think, you know, for banks like us, that this is what we do every day, you know, for a lot of investors or, you know, real estate related people, you know, we can bring other thoughts, resources, experience, expertise, maybe to the table that the client wasn't thinking about. So try to make it pretty back and forth, collaborative. I really dislike the process you described where it kind of goes into the black hole and you don't really know why people are asking you for stuff. We certainly ask for a lot of financial information, but it has a purpose. And as we go through that, we're going to ask you a lot of questions, say, what does all this stuff mean? And because your accountant is doing your tax returns in a different way than what we would want to see. So there's some interpretation there we have to do. And but you know what I try to tell our lenders, we want to get to yes or no as fast as we can. I don't like wasting people's time. People don't like their time being wasted. So let's do that. And if we can't do something, let's make sure that people understand why we couldn't do it. Maybe they can in the future. Maybe they could do it a different way. Can we refer them to somebody else? We try not to make things, you know, we try to, if it's not something we can do, we try to point you in the right direction, I guess.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. That's how I got pointed to you. I had talked to the client, and he said, here, try to talk to these guys. And then they looked at it and said, no, call these guys. And I thought it was kind of interesting that the banks were and especially these were more community-type banks, were willing to suggest another alternative kind of thing. And that's how I was introduced to you guys.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's when we've done that lots of times too. We might refer somebody to another financial institution that we know would maybe be a better fit for any particular type of project.
Let me ask you about the capacity or what, not capacity per se, but what is kind of a sweet spot loans type opportunity that you guys would entertain?
Sure. Well, I could say that our average loan size, if you just divided the total by the number of loans, is probably 500,000. So not real large, but you know, we have projects that are 6-7 million down to, you know, 50,000. But I would say primarily when it probably makes the most sense is in that 1 million to 2 million range. The biggest banks, they have a very automated kind of process for loans of that size, so they can have scale, which makes it difficult for a smaller real estate investor to get that expertise in that loan size. So I think that's what a community bank can bring to the table in those size loans. And it could be equipment, it could be, you know, it could be various different purposes. Real estate specific, though, that's kind of the loan size that I think where we bring the most value to the table.
With the loans that you guys make, and I don't know if this is common answer for most community banks or not, do you guys retain the loans or do you sell the loans? Do you service your loans?
Yes, all of the above. We may sell loans from time to time for various reasons. Maybe we have a concentration in a particular subcategory. But for the most part, what you'll see community banks do is sell pieces of loans back and forth. We call them participations. Mm-hmm. And all banks do participations, even the largest banks. And what that allows is the lead bank, we've done both, we buy in and sell participations from time to time, allows the lead bank to still retain the relationship with the client. The client doesn't know because it's just kind of a balance sheet management thing. It's on the back end. Bank A still services the loan, still has the relationship, and then what Bank A does is split the payment kind of behind the scenes when the check comes in, splits it between how the loan is structured. Maybe I have 50%, maybe another community bank that I know well has 50%, and then we do it behind the scenes. So that's very typical.
And it sounds like in more of it, though, you retain more of the loans. Is that fair?
Oh, yes. It's not very common for small banks to sell the loans, and I think that's another part of the process and why it is so maybe labor intensive. Maybe it feels that way. Hopefully it doesn't feel that bad to the client, but it's why we want to know it so well, because we will live with that loan. You know, We're not just hoping that we can get it approved so it's somebody else's problem. You know, which was a big problem with the mortgage meltdown. Everybody was originating, never planning on keeping the debt.
Right.
We keep all the debt and just getting their fees. I live with that until it goes away in a positive way or in a not positive way. So, you know, even today, I would say at least I see probably 50% in person, 50% of the collateral that we lend on personally. And 90% of our loans are in the three-county area, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington. And I want to know where it is, what's next door, you know, all the things that the investor thinks about. If this thing doesn't work, you know, what am I going to do? What's my plan B? So we're very aligned that way with the client. You know, we want it to work, and we think about it kind of the same way up front. You know, I think a lot of times people think that the bank is, you know, almost look at a bank as like a joint venture, and it's really not. You know, we are the cheapest, banking is the cheapest funding source, much cheaper than another investor. You don't have to share your upside with. We're just really renting the money. And so we can't have, you know, we can't really have losses. I think, you know, if our net income, which is for a bank our size very good, is, you know, over $1 million a year, on that $1 million of net income, we can't take many losses and make much money. So it has to, you know, we have to be able to get our money back. And so all that upfront work we do, making sure we're a good fit with the client, making sure the client's a good fit with us. I mean, because it's a two-way street. I've told people, there's certain clients, because of their financial structure, if they're super complicated, it's not that we can't understand it or that we don't have smart people here. It's just not going to be a good fit for us on an ongoing basis. And people are surprised when I tell them that. And it's not to be rude. It's just there's other financial institutions that are going to be a better fit for you than us, because you're going to be unhappy with us as we go along, and we're going to be unhappy with you because we're going to be asking you for all this stuff. So we really think about, and I think companies in general should do that. Who is your market? How do you serve them? And don't get outside of things that are not going to be a good fit just because you're trying to chase that next sale. You know, let's say make sure it's the right customer, so the experience is good for both parties.
Yeah, no, that's some wisdom right there. Stay in your lane, kind of thing. I know.
Stay in your lane. Yes.
Yeah, I know. When I started out insurance, it was kind of just, you know, work with anybody I could. It's more of a survival mode than it was anything else, as opposed to kind of eventually getting more into, and now all I go after and try and work with are people in real estate, whether they be, you know, investors or developers or anyone associated with that. But I hear what you're saying there. I wanted to kind of go back to the 2008, now that we've been through that, and the changes that have come about, it sounds like they're primarily consumer protection things. Have they affected the way you guys do business?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, and it's a constant. It's something that I think a lot about, because I think a lot of people in the industry, both banking and from a regulatory perspective, spend too much time fighting the last war, which is kind of where we find ourselves now, you know, as an industry, in terms of how we do things. You know, I don't know that we do really do, from an underwriting perspective, we do anything that different. I think we were kind of an outlier going into the recession because there's certain things we did and certain things we didn't do. And I don't think anything from the recession changed my view on what proper underwriting is. You know, with the exception of being a little more focused on type of client. I think you described it well. You know, when you start off, you know, you got to work with a lot of people because you need to get your business up and running. I think we're a little more focused on the type of client that is going to be a good fit for us. Because, what we did when we did have problem loans, we'd go back and we'd kind of have a postmortem and say, okay, what went wrong? Could we have foreseen it? What could we have done differently? What went right? All that kind of stuff. And there was some very there was some very stark similarities. People that we had the most trouble with were people that, you know, you could say really lacked more of that character thing. And I don't mean fraudulent. So that's not what I mean. What I mean is, you know, if you sign a loan agreement or you sign any agreement, there's a expectation that you're going to live up to the agreement. And there are certain people that during the recession that thought that, well, it didn't work out for me, so I'm not going to do the hard thing because I don't want to have to deal with it. And that doesn't work. I'm a small business as well, and I have, you know, I want to get my money back for our investors. And so, you know, if somebody has financial difficulty, I'm more than willing to work with them and try to make sure that we can work things out and get a resolution. But when people want to come in and say, hey, it's not really working in my favor, I don't plan on living up to the personal guarantee I signed, and I'm just going to drop the keys on your desk. Those kind of people had a lot of similarities. There was certain things about their, you know, the way they do things. So we're pretty strict on that, on that part of our business. But in terms of how we underwrite a particular project or the things we're looking for, those are really the same. They really haven't changed because it served us well that, you know, the things that we did, and thinking about the things that we did right, those kinds of things that we did, you know, we didn't have trouble with. Clients were able to get out of the property if they needed to, or, you know, they had flexibility because we didn't overlend on it. And if I could say, you know, one thing, as much as over leverage hurts a bank, it hurts a real estate investor too. And, you know, when things slow down, that's the people that got hurt the most, is the people that didn't have any liquidity and were over leveraged. And that wasn't different 50 years ago as it was in 2008. You know, that's something that's pretty fundamental to it.
Right. Having gone through this, and do you have any sense of go forward that, you know, what the future holds as far as, I mean, I obviously you don't have a crystal ball, but I'm just, sure. And it's interesting. I mean, today is actually election day, yeah. Which one of the more crazy elections from that I've ever witnessed, and I think in all of, you know, the U.S. history that we're experiencing. But I'm kind of curious. I think at the end of the day, I think everything will go forward. I think everybody believes in that. But I'm just kind of curious, do you have any kind of a sense as to what if or how things might be different, or are there any things that you guys are paying attention to? I mean, there's a lot of talk, and I'll say this and let you answer, but I know the Feds have been wanting to raise interest rates now for a number of years. And it sounds like they're pretty set on in their December meeting making that happen.
Yeah, that's a lot of that is a huge question. And you know, we do talk about all those things. And I think what we try to avoid is, you know, I think for any of us, whatever we do, it's easy to talk yourself into things. You know, you can see what you want to see, and I try to avoid that. And so that what if kind of process, we build that into our underwriting as much as we can. You know, what if interest rates went up? What would that do to it? Knowing that we're never going to be right. We just have to, you know, think about the contingencies. I mean, we're never going to get it exact. We plan for higher rates, but I don't think we'll see them. We plan for lower valuations. I don't know that we'll see it across the board. I think we have pockets that may be overheating. But, you know, it is so local. And in our case, very West Coast, Seattle, well, let's say Puget Sound, Portland, San Francisco, you know, as you go down the coast, that at least for now and you know, maybe for the foreseeable future, the demographics are certainly in our favor for people moving here, and that has continued. And one of the downsides to the recession was you had no real new construction for a number of years. And so when you have no new inventory, you have an urban growth boundary that keeps a lid on that in another way, and then you have a lot of net migration in, prices can only do one thing, and that's what we're seeing. Now, do we get overbuilt in apartments? Probably. I don't know that I see. So, you know, I guess we all try to relate it to something we know, and that in the most recent history is 2008. I don't know that it goes exactly like 2008. I think you could have pockets that get hurt. Let's say multifamily, maybe it even is as specific as submarkets. But I think, you know, rates will stay probably low for a while. You have the baby boomers retiring. And you have the you know, bigger generation of the millennials just kind of getting into the workforce. They're not going to be at their peak spending years, you know, for a while. So I don't see the economic output really pushing rates so fast as maybe we thought a few years ago. But like I said, we try to think about all of those things maybe happening anyway. And so we kind of have our what we think is the most likely case, and then we do a lot of worst case planning. And you know, if I tell borrowers one thing over and over again, it's keep liquidity. And one thing I saw coming out of the 08 recession, the people that really made money had liquidity and were able to buy when there were opportunities. And so I try to keep that in mind, you know, keep your liquidity, make sure you have flexibility to do what you want to do if, you know, any of those opportunities come up.
Sounds like some good advice. And I think it's, you know, I think what I see so often is that people get caught up in the frenzy of where the market's going.
Yes.
And
yes.
forget whatever bad things happened and, or, you know, of mine, that can't happen again.
Very true.
Jeff, I want to be respectful of your time. I was looking on the clock here. We've been going for a while. I was going to ask you if you had some advice for investors, but I'm going to say that what you just said might be that, unless you've got some other sage wisdom you'd like to share.
Well, I think the people that I see that are successful have trusted advisors in a variety of disciplines, insurance, legal, you know, banking, let's say. And, you know, running around trying to find the lower price might not be the best deal all the time. So, you know, get a CPA. That's another one you got to have. You know, get your trusted advisors in those areas, people that you can call on, people that you know are going to give you the straight answer and the right information, and have a relationship with them. And that's critical. I see less and less of that all the time, you know, as we move everything towards, you know, you got to use your phone or your computer to interface with everything. And that makes sense in a lot of things that we do, no question. I mean, I'd much rather take a picture of my deposit and, you know, do it that way than having to go stand in line at the bank. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people that allow you to get the things done in your business that you want to get done. And it takes all of those people. I don't know how many times I've talked to people about you need to talk to your insurance person about the risk part of this. You know, it's like, well, I didn't really, you know, like you just mentioned 2008 or what people are doing now, maybe in some cases not thinking nothing bad can happen. And maybe that's our need to be optimistic. But there's all the different disciplines you need to have. And that's the main thing I stress to clients is have somebody good in all those areas that can help you. It's you know, take the long view of what you're trying to do.
Well, that's great advice, and I would fully express that to anyone that I speak with. I think that the consumption age we live in has taught us that there's always a better deal out there.
Right.
And I think that too often, whether it's you're buying a jar of peanut butter or getting a loan or buying an insurance policy, we're all convinced that there's a better price elsewhere, and if I just Google it, I can get it. And not understanding the fine print or the value of why one might be different or better or more expensive, it is a challenge to fight the commoditization or the view that everything's a commodity. And I know in my business, it's constantly because everybody looks at it, limit, low price wins,
And, right.
Not understanding the text there, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think it's very true. I think it's the difference between people that are successful and not successful, really. You know, they can utilize, successful people utilize their resources, and people, are certainly a resource. I'm not an insurance expert, so I would have to talk to somebody. I'm not a CPA. Even though we look at financials, so we need to talk to the CPA. And that I think that helps you as a borrower. If you're just thinking about the lending side, if I can, talk to you and I can call your CPA to get the stuff, I can get your, builder's risk or whatever kind of risk from your agent, and all those things work together, it is a much smoother process, no question.
Agreed. Jeff, I've totally appreciated this. I can't say thank you enough for taking the time to talk with us today. What's the best way for somebody to reach you or Lewis and Clark Bank if they were wanting to reach out and engage?
Oh, sure. Thank you for that. So our bank website's probably the first place to go if somebody wanted to know more about the bank. We're proud of the site that we put together, and from the perspective, I think it tells a little bit about us. That's lewisandclarkbank.com. My email is on there as well as all of our employees' emails are on there. And the main phone number for the bank is 503-212-3200, and any of those outlets would work to get a hold of our bank specifically.
Well, Jeff, thanks again, and wish you continued success.
Well, thank you, and you, as you mentioned in the beginning, you're a client, and we appreciate that. So thank you for doing business with us.
You got it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I've had the pleasure of working with a couple of community banks, including Lewis and Clark. And if you're looking to purchase a property, I can't encourage you enough to check out what options are available to you with some of the community banks. Sometimes they have some unique opportunities. And if the property fits and it's a good fit, it's typically a very good fit. For more information about Lewis and Clark, go ahead and look in the show notes, or you can go ahead and search them and find them at lewisandclarkbank.com. Well, that's all we have for you today. We're so glad you tuned in. We know you're busy, and we thank you for making time for us today. We do appreciate you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Networks CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.